Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled A Conversation on the Right, Should the Federal Government Shape School Curriculum? Our moderator today is Sarah Parshall Perry. Sarah is the Vice President and Legal Fellow at Defending Education. Before joining Defending Education, Sarah served as a Senior Legal Fellow for the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, part of the Institute for Constitutional Government at Heritage, where her work centered on civil rights and the proper role of the courts. Robert Eitel is the co-founder and president of the Defense of Freedom Institute. He previously served as senior counselor to the Secretary of Education and Deputy General Counsel of the U.S. Department of Education. During his most recent tenure at the department, Bob served on the Secretary's leadership team as a strategic advisor and legal advisor on higher education, civil rights, and congressional oversight matters. Roger Severino is Vice President of Domestic Policy and the Joseph C. Elizabeth A. Anderlich Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Roger spearheaded the Health and Human Services Accountability Project while a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Previously, Roger was the director of the HHS's Office for Civil Rights, where he led a team of over 250 staff enforcing the United States civil rights, conscious and religious freedom, and health information privacy laws. He was the longest serving OCR director of the past three decades. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, everyone. Well, Americans are losing confidence in public education. In January morning, Consult and EdChoice polling revealed that over half of Americans say that K through 12 education is on the wrong track nationwide. And the percentage who say education is failing their children is actually even lower. Half of parents think that K through 12 education is poorly performing, and parents are more positive about their local schools, though positivity has generally fallen since November of 2024. According to the Wall Street Journal, 56% of Americans now believe that a four-year college education is no longer worth the cost. And people are less likely to say that colleges and universities have a positive impact on the direction of the nation as a whole. Now, this changing sentiment has translated into falling enrollment as well. In fact, the number of students attending college has dropped 12% since its peak in 2010. Public sentiment is divided. Many Americans believe that the focus on core subjects has been lost, and the influence of personal views in the classroom are major concerns. So, how to fix the problem? Well, today, we three will posit that curricular rigor and high-quality pedagogy point the way to higher standards in American education and better performance for America's children. But as we know, education is best managed and overseen at the state and local level. Does the federal government have any role to play? Much has been made, obviously, in the national media here. Discussions about education policy, civil rights investigations, and dismantling the Department of Education, obviously. But I'll give our panelists today an opportunity to talk about something that we will be addressing with curricular involvement by the federal government. So I will allow five-minute opening, and then I'll lead the moderated discussion. So, Bob, why don't I start with you?
Certainly, I'd be happy to start. I don't disagree with your initial assessment about the state of public education in the United States. I think we all know the statistics. We've seen the nation's report card. The fact is that at least public K-12 in the United States is not in good shape. There's a number of reasons for that. We can talk about them later. I'm particularly alarmed at the lack of American history and civics education in the United States. And if you think about the state of that area, it's underscored by the fact that in 2018, the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship conducted a foundation conducted a survey which found that fewer than one in three Americans could answer correctly the 100 question American history and civics test required for the naturalization process for new citizens. Recent results from the nation's report card simply underscore that everyday Americans' knowledge of civics and history in particular remain poor, if not in other areas as well. I also agree with the notion that this lack of understanding about America's founding principles, its heritage, and its government will lead or can could lead, probably will lead to a crisis in the American political system. The fact of the matter is that too many Americans lack basic knowledge about the Constitution, about the country's history, and what we mean as a country. And I think you can trace much of that to failures in American K-12. I think, though, that the answer to this problem is not the federal government. I think the question is, how do we head off the crisis and what is the means that we use? And I would argue that the matter is best left to states, localities, and parents, and not the federal government. There's several reasons for my position. The first is simply has to do with federalism, the 10th Amendment. The fact of the matter is that states and localities take the lead on education. The 10th has taken a beating over the years. I am not a scholar in the 10th Amendment, but I think we could all agree that the founders surely intended for education to remain a state and local matter. This was mainly the case in the United States until the Great Society legislation of the 1960s that wildly expanded the federal role in K-12, and it's been expanding ever since. There's other reasons for my concern about the federal role. My primary legal one is not so much constitutional as it is statutory. There are important statutory hurdles presented by federal law, specifically in the General Education Provisions Act, the Department of Education Organizations Act, and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, as amended by the Every Student Succeeds Act of 2015, that each of them contains a prohibition on federal agencies generally, in the Department of Education specifically, from exercising any direction, supervision, or control over the curriculum of any school system or school in connection with any program administered by the federal government. We need to be very cognizant of those limitations, because very often they are ignored and have been. We can talk about that later in the context of the Common Core and the Obama administration's Race to the Top program in the early 2010s. But even without these statutory and constitutional concerns, I would argue that the federal government just hasn't had a good track record on improving education in the United States. The fact of the matter is that since 1980, when Congress established the Education Department, federal spending has increased massively, trillions of dollars, while academic achievement has flatlined. There are programs that the Department of Education has run over the years that have had no impact on achievement. And in fact, I would argue that given the flatlining and test scores have been harmful. There's another concern that we should all should be aware of, in addition to these sort of policy and constitutional and statutory concerns, and that is the fact of ideological capture. Meaning that if one creates a government program and bureaucracy to run that program, it is, I think, inevitable that the left will ultimately, over time, take over that bureaucracy or that program and leverage that bureaucracy or program to the to progressive ends. We see this time and time again. And my concern is that any effort by the federal government to shape a national curriculum in K-12 will ultimately and inevitably fall to these influences. Yes, this does happen at the state and local level. You don't have to look any further than a big city school system like Chicago Public Schools to see that this sort of left-wing influence can take over a school system and frankly destroy it. But I would argue at least it's just that jurisdiction that is affected and it doesn't have a national effect. One thing I do want to talk with Sarah is at some point during this conversation is the disaster that was the Common Core Curriculum Initiative and how the federal government abused its power to manipulate race to the top grant program that the Obama administration administered in order to leverage the Common Core curriculum. I think that's an important part of the discussion. Let me just conclude with some caveats to all this. There is a federal role to play on the periphery in terms of educating America's school children, but it's not through curriculum. It's through things like the Smithsonian, the museums, national historic sites and landmarks, American military parks, things like the bicentennial of 1976, which I think led to a resurgence of patriotism in the 1980s. That's the sort of thing that the federal government does. Again, I'll look forward to talking at length more deeply about each of these, but those are my concerns.
Roger, let me pass the floor to you both to respond a little bit to some of these overarching principles that we just heard from Bob, but also to sort of give a status of what you believe the federal government's role, if any, could be or should be in shaping curricular policy.
Sure. So I'll quote the Constitution, Article 9. A general diffusion of knowledge and intelligence being essential to the preservation of the rights and liberties of the people, the legislature shall encourage by all suitable means the promotion of intellectual, scientific, moral, and agricultural improvement. That's not the U.S. Constitution. That's the California Constitution, because there is no similar provision in the U.S. Constitution, because the U.S. Constitution is the federal government of limited enumerated powers, and nowhere in that Constitution is there a general right to the provision of education. Yet our current Department of Education seems to believe that there is, and therein lies the problem. If you look at state constitutions, and I just cited one small portion of California, it goes on and on in their constitution. It talks about school boards and curricula and textbooks, and it should be a free and open education. There's formative grants, and that's how it should be. Their constitutional provisions on education are exceedingly long because that's where the power resides. And that's what the framers intended. Of course, if it's not an enumerated power, there is no federal power over education. And therein lies the problem. If you want to get a sense of how bad it could get, well, look what happened with COVID. It was the federal government through Anthony Fauci and in CDC, HHS saying we have to lock down all the schools. And that guidance was adopted, unfortunately, by state after state after state. And they shut down the schools because of federal pressure. And that was disastrous to the American student. There's a whole lost generation. Now, a few states, Florida and others, resisted. And they said, you know what? This is actually something where we have the authority over ultimately, and they exercise their power. Imagine if the federal government actually had the power. They would have shut down all the schools. They would have masked all the little kids. At least under the federal system, we had some pieces of liberty that prevailed. That's why you don't want to centralize the power. When you centralize it, you're going to lead to bad outcomes. Now, we already have a government monopoly system by and large, even at the state level. Right. The publicly funded schools ended up being a publicly funded bureaucracy captured by teachers' unions. So it's not enough to say simply the federal government needs to step out. We also need to have tremendous amounts of reform at the K-12 level but through the states. So we are all in favor of shutting down the Department of Education. It is metastasized into something that is beyond the constitutional bounds, and especially when it comes to things like curriculum and dictating what belongs to curriculum. Bob's exactly right. Those three statutes he mentioned are the ones that prohibit under federal law, because even when the Department of Education was stood up, the whole idea was it was going to take all these separate programs in various agencies, put them under one roof for efficiencies. No, they got captured by the National Education Association and the teachers unions, and it just became part of the DC blob, just another special interest that hands out money. And we've seen by the national test scores of proficiency, it hasn't worked. Throwing more money, especially coming from the federal government, has not helped to actually improve test scores. We believe at Heritage Foundation that the education choice, empowering parents, is the solution to this. We're big proponents of ESAs. These are savings accounts that you could take it away, put it away into a accounts that actually grow and that are yours, that can be invested in the market and are tax-free and are dedicated to education. They should be funded as well by the states. States should contribute money to these accounts as well to give parents the power over their own education choices for their children. When you have competition at the K through 12 level in particular, you will have better education outcomes, right? That this is an ironclad rule of economics. Government monopolies are terrible at servicing the customer. They're one of the worst possible ways because they don't feel competitive pressures. The answers that you will always get from the public education cartels 100% of the time is, we need more money. Well, DC, for example, one of the best funded school districts in the nation, has some of the worst outcomes. The per pupil student funding is through the roof, and they have had some of the worst outcomes in America. Now, they've had some semblance of school choice, which there's always been a fight in Congress. And who lines up to take advantage of these? African-American families. If they were so happy with the public school systems, they wouldn't be flocking to school choice whenever they get even some semblance of an option. We're also in favor of, if there is any federal government role in this, something like tax credit for sponsoring scholarship granting organizations, SGOs, so that those organizations that provide support in the states through scholarships get tax benefits or tax credits. That's about as far as it could go for a federal role. And it is worlds away from actually dictating curriculum. One final point. There is one issue where the federal government does have a very important role, and that is in civil rights enforcement. It is absolutely appropriate for the federal government to say, if you receive federal funds, you cannot have boys competing against girls in sports that endanger them physically, are unfair. And when it comes to locker rooms, it actually violates their privacy and security. Right? There's under Title IX, there's absolutely a federal role there in education through K through 12 when it comes to civil rights. Same thing with DEI. If you have literal segregation of classes based on race, because they're doing some woke exercise, or if affinity groups that are being sponsored and have limitations on who could be part of the club, or if you try to force kids to say that one race is superior to another, or one is a oppressor class always, and make them role play it, then you start crossing the line to actual discrimination, where there's federal government role in putting an end to that. Because there should be access, equal access to everybody in education. And that's the extent of the federal role. And it's really important now that they step in on that to protect women and girls. The other curricular issues, leave it to the states, have school choice, block grant as much of the government funds as possible, and shut down the Department of Education. President Trump is well on his way to doing that.
Sarah, could I just say something in response to Roger?
Yes.
Let me underscore that I and DFI institutionally support a strong federal role in civil rights enforcement. That is a core mission for DFI. Roger's absolutely right about Title IX and Title VI in terms of sex and race discrimination, some of the issues that we've seen over the last several years, particularly in the prior administration, in the way they enforced both statutes was simply contrary to their intent. And I might add that yesterday DFI has introduced a model law for Title IX that addresses many of the deficiencies that we've seen arise out of the prior administration's enforcement of Title IX.
So there's lots of rich landscape, I think, to plumb. Both of you mentioned the nation's report card and what we saw after COVID, and we may all be eager to put the effects of COVID behind us. But the fact of the matter is that 5 years later, our most recent nation's report card scores, the NAEP scores, which come out every year, have indicated historic drops since 2022. I'll just give a few highlights that we can address, and two curricular poor areas, one with reading and one with math. Overall, the reading scores are down nationally in both fourth grade and eighth grade. No state saw greater gains compared to where they were in 2022, and a full third of eighth graders are not even reading at the basic level. That is a historic high. 33% of them are not reading at basic level. In math, in fourth grade, math scores are slightly up by 2 points in fourth grade, but in eighth grade, math scores are flat nationally and also close to only 30% proficiency rate. So these are two core curricular inclusions. Obviously, math and English, every student has to take math and English at some point. So let's talk about where some of these disparities are actually coming from. Is it a result of what, Bob, you mentioned as ideological capture? Are we too busy teaching values institutionally when it comes to sort of a progressive ideology that we are actually losing valuable classroom time on teaching fundamentals, or is there something else to blame?
Well, it's an issue, but I would not overstate it. These trends in academic performance, the downward trend in academic performance generally has been occurring for years. Before this rise in gender ideology and DEI, critical race theory teachings in schools developed. So I would not overstate it. I do think it's an issue, but I wouldn't call it even the primary determinant. I think there are much more deeper issues with the state of our school systems that have given rise to these test results that have nothing to do with the time spent on DEI or critical race theory or critical gender theory, although that has aggravated the issue in the last several years.
Roger, what about you? Where do you think some of these curricular weaknesses come from? Is this sort of institutional capture by particular ideologies? Does it come from a failure at the state and local level to legislate into law those particular curricular inclusions that are required, or is there something else?
Problem is misaligned incentives.
Right? I think you're muted, Roger.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
I think somehow the audio dipped a little bit.
Okay. So the major problem deals with misaligned incentives. The system is structured currently to reward the wrong things. It is structured based on measuring inputs, how much money per student. That's pretty much what teachers' union demand more than anything. And then they'll do things like, okay, we want to get lower class sizes and the number of teachers per student. I'll try to speak up more loudly. The number of teachers per student, right? They'll try to go to other metrics when the most important part is the actual education outcomes. Are the students learning or not? And then tying the incentives to that. If you actually have funding tied to the education outcomes at the state level, you'll have massive change. But we have government monopolies where, based on where you live, what zip code you're in, that's the school you must go to. So you have a captured population who must go to that school And they are trapped because no matter what, those teachers are still going to get paid, whether the students do well or not. It's formula based, usually on the number of students in that school. And then there is also some state based balancing because you don't want to have the rich school districts get all the money. So there's some state redistribution. But again, it goes down to the incentives. It's just dollars per student is all that they're pushing for instead of the outcomes. We've had, you should check out the Heritage Foundation. We have an education freedom report card. Lindsay Burt is wonderful. She's the director of our education center here. And they rank the schools on these questions of student choice, education choice, teacher freedom, transparency, and the return on investment. And Louisiana, for example, did quite well on the latest student scores. And they have phonics-based teaching, right? And they have school choice. These sort of things go hand in hand. If you have empowerment of the parents to have control over the education dollars, if the parents are the true consumers, then the problem practically solves itself, because nobody cares more about the educational outcomes of these kids than the parents. A unionized teacher certainly doesn't, and a superintendent doesn't, and a DC bureaucrat least of all.
Thank you, Roger. Roger, we still seem to be having a little bit of trouble with your audio. I can hear you, but it's very limited. Bob, I don't know if it's the same for you as well, but
yes.
Okay.
I just switched it. How's that?
Oh, there. Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what Bob mentioned earlier. And this is something I'm particularly passionate about because it really was sort of my introduction into education reform generally, but that was the Common Core State Standards, which these were instituted again under the Obama administration, as Bob mentioned previously. And they were essentially a carrot and stick approach to national education. In other words, for these particular tax dollars to flow, teaching had to be done to particular national standards, which of course had the effect of institutionalizing an entire federal curriculum because all of the standardized testing was itself centralized. All of this really was teaching to the standards, which were all tested and assessed at the national level. So, Bob, talk a little bit about the Common Core State Standards experiment and exactly the impact that had on education.
So let me just give some context for people who's this. Because the folks who've not been following education policy, it's a little bit of history. So you have to understand that the Common Core State Standard Initiative was not a creature of state legislators, but it was a creature of two Washington, D.C.-based organizations, the National Governors Association, something called the Center for Best Practices, and the Council of Chief State School Officers, which is an organization of state education agency heads based in D.C. And they coordinated the Common Core State Standards Initiative to establish a voluntary national elementary and secondary education standards in mathematics and English language arts. The standards included two categories: college and career ready standards, which were to address what students were expected to have learned when they had graduated from high school, and then the K-12 standards, which address expectations from elementary school through high school. The final K-12 Common Core standards were announced in the summer of 2010. This is during the Obama administration. And after they were developed, states began to adopt the standards. And by 2012, 45 states, D.C., two territories had adopted the Common Core standards in English language arts and mathematics. The standards were harshly criticized by a number of experts, including Jay Green, who is now at the Heritage Foundation, who described the standards as mediocre, as well as other experts like Sandra Stotsky and Zev Herman, who are experts in this area. Simultaneously to this, in early 2009, President Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And that act provided for the Department of Education funds for something called Race to the Top, which consisted of two programs, the Race to the Top Fund and the Race to the Top Assessment Program. These are basically competitive grant programs designed supposedly with the hope of spurring innovation in K-12. $4 billion to disperse, which in those days was a lot of money, and it attracted applications from 46 states. Now, here's the rub. In order to participate in the Race to the Top programs, the department required each state to adopt common K-12 standards. Not the Common Core, but common K-12 standards. Well, while all this was happening, the department was advertising for Race to the Top and dangling all this money out to state educational agencies and school districts. What did they do? They took something off the shelf, ready-made, ready to go, and those were the Common Core standards. They simply used the Common Core as part of their applications. So although the department did not expressly mandate states to adopt the Common Core in order to participate in Race to the Top, it didn't have to, because nearly every state adopted them voluntarily so that it can make it easier for them to apply for the Race to the Top funding. So, and that's what happened. And so, there was so-called grant competitions. The department handed out money. The states adopted the Common Core standards. There's another issue relating to No Child Left Behind and certain waivers under those accountability requirements that the department waived in front of states to entice them to engage into the Race to the Top program and to pass the Common Core standards. But long story short, they all rushed in to do it. There was a major backlash to the Common Core. It frankly, I think, gave rise to, sort of the MAGA moms movement that you see today. In the early days, many people came into education reform because of their opposition to the Common Core. And indeed, their backlash was so bad that when Congress reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in 2015, they included special prohibitions for the federal government, which went beyond, frankly, GEPA and the Department of Education Organizational Act to explicitly bar the department from using the Common Core and standards as an enticement for grants or contracts. So that's the background of the Common Core.
All right, could I jump in?
Absolutely.
Now that my audio is fixed, I made amazing points. You guys missed it. Okay. But it comes back to incentives, that if the incentives are misaligned, then you're not going to get the good outcomes. The incentives currently are structured to follow the money. The more money there is per student, that's what's measured as success. That's all about inputs. It's not about outputs. And when you have a government monopoly where people are required to send their kids to the school based on their zip code, you have a captured audience and you have a consumer that has no other choice, and there's no incentive to actually get the education outcome. If you get student choice, then you have the parents controlling the dollars, not the bureaucracy. And who cares more about kids than the parents? Nobody. So least of all, a federal bureaucrat in DC. So when you empower the parents, they're the ones who will say, I will take my kid elsewhere to get a better curriculum, because they're the ones who care about the education outcomes. I recommend the Heritage Foundation's Education Freedom Report Card. Dr. Lindsay Burke, head of our education center, is amazing, and she'll put it together. It ranks all the states based on education choice, transparency, teacher freedom, return on investment. Louisiana is a great example. They have great education choice. They have phonics-based teaching. They rank, and they did very well in the test scores this last time around. Canada does better on education, and they don't have centralized curriculum, and they don't have the bureaucracy we have either. So it's not something where we are condemned to this method as being the only way. If you empower the parents, the problem will solve itself.
That's a great point. Yes, Bob.
Yeah, I just want to say, to Roger's point, I mean, I think the point we're all trying to make here is, in the Common Core, simply in the way the Obama administration manipulated the Common Core and the Race to the Top grant program, is that be careful about those on the right or the left who argue that the federal government should have a role in curriculum, either mandating it or shaping it. Because you can see these indirect means that the central government can use to manipulate state behavior, who are always in search of more funding, to leverage a certain policy goal or a set of curricular priorities that a number of Americans, you know, that most Americans may not agree with. And I think Roger's right. I mean, the core here is allowing families to choose the education that is best for their child through education freedom policies at the state level.
So we have two questions. Let me get to the first. So we have a question from Jessica, who asks, what happens when you give power to the states and the districts and the counties? So here we are at the local level, play games with funding, specifically IDEA funding, and they are having a problem, it appears, in just that respect in South Florida, where they've been denying access to private school students.
Well, there's a case at the Supreme Court dealing with charter schools that are religious and whether or not they could have access on equal terms. So look, the education monopoly fights for its own turf, almost like the mafia does, right? They hate the idea of education choice. They resisted charter schools for a long time, which are a hybrid, and they have been excluding religious schools from the get-go. I mean, it goes back to Blaine Amendments from, you know, 1850s to 1870s. It's always been this fight. So yeah, there's a lot of gamesmanship going on, even at the state level, to exclude choice. And that's a perennial problem. Hopefully, with at least religious schools, the Supreme Court is going to solve it once and for all.
Yeah, agreed. I think the questioner too raises a very valid point, which is simply taking the federal government out of educational policy or curriculum does not solve the problems that parents face. There's a new set of problems that need to be solved at the state and local level. And I think one of the major problems faced by parents, particularly in major metropolitan areas, is the influence of the teacher unions upon big city school boards. And the fact of the matter is that the unions, you see this in places like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, other major cities, particularly, elect the school boards. These school board elections are usually an off-year election cycles where the turnout is very low. They're very often nonpartisan, which effectively means that it's difficult to ascertain where their political leanings are. And the teacher unions dive into these school board elections and very often will elect those very people that negotiate collective bargaining agreements with them, which all of which have, can have a terrible effect on the educational quality that one sees in public schools. So, I don't think we're arguing that taking the federal government solves all problems. It just avoids a major set of problems that arise through bureaucratic centralized control. You're still going to have to work for it at home, I guess is the way to put it.
And that goes to one of the other questions we had, which is sort of the shifting of the influence of unions, both from the federal level down into the states, specifically states with particular left-leaning ideologies, because these are, again, unions that not just exist under the sort of federal umbrella and are sort of in relationship, in concert with the Federal Department of Education, as they have been for so long. We know the NEA and the AFT have essentially exercised outsized influence in public education generally, and were a major function of the fact that our schools remained closed during the COVID pandemic, and we saw these resultant learning losses. So in shifting the energy to the state and local level, Bob, is it, and Roger, I'll pass this to you, as Bob sort of already hinted at his answer, what are some strategies to sort of defeat the influence of unions when parents are, for example, trapped in a particular school district, if they don't have the option for educational choice, which, of course, I think we are all in agreement on, but we also know the reality is 90% of American parents send their children to public education environments, either out of necessity or because they, for example, need special education services like my boys did. And those protections are not automatically available in a private religious school, for example, that does not take taxpayer funding. So what are some options to sort of make sure that these particular curricular inclusions are rigorous at the state and local level, and that parents and school board members can overcome the influence of a lot of these unions?
Okay, multifaceted problem. But if there's limited school choice, then parents have to get involved in their local school districts. They have to attend the meetings, they have to advocate. And this is what happened in the last election. Moms across the country stood up because gender ideology was endangering their children. And you had parents speaking up at school board meetings, and there was a famous one of a parent getting arrested after his, he was a father, after his daughter was raped in a bathroom by a schoolboy in a skirt. And this was Loudoun County, and the school district looked the other way. And if you recall, this was there was an investigation of parents by Attorney General Garland, okay, issued a memo to address so-called threats to school boards. What prompted that? Well, it was a letter from the National School Boards Association sent to Attorney General Garland that spun up the U.S. Department of Justice to treat parents as akin to terrorists, right? That was the blowback that we got from these special interests. But it was parents standing up that were decisive. The truth eventually came out that it was the school boards that were at fault and were covering up these harms. And that actually led to part of the election outcome that we had this last go around at the presidential level. So it started from parents getting involved at the school board level. And that is key. And at Heritage, we actually train school board members on how to, you know, effectively run a school district. But it really comes down to the parents being active. We saw Moms for Liberty come out of this grassroots effort. Get involved. And even if you don't have a kid in your school district, you're paying the taxes. Attend those meetings, advocate on their behalf.
And just add to that, if you live in a school district where there is no collective bargaining allowed in your for your school system, my strongest advice is to keep it that way. The worst thing that can happen is for your school district to adopt a policy, and sometimes this is a question of state law, that allows for collective bargaining rights for teachers and administrative support personnel for a public school system, because that is the beginning of a long road to a teacher union takeover of the school system and the schools, where the focus of education of the system becomes not the students, but the teachers, the employees. Teachers are critical, teachers are important, but at the end of the day, it's the students that should be the priority. And when you have a collective bargaining agreement in place that allows for teacher unions to come in, effectively take over HR policies and what teachers will be teaching and how they'll be teaching it and when, you know, many of these issues we talked about regarding gender ideology and critical race theory came into school systems because some collective bargaining agreements in some school systems mandated that. They were in the CBAs, and it was that's a contractual requirement to include those teachings. So that would be point one. The second point I want to make is be aware, you should just be aware of the fact of the role the state legislatures play. Most state legislatures have a role to play in public schools in their states as well, in that they will establish the curriculum, like they will or the standards followed by the school systems in that state. So be very aware of what your state legislature is doing, what they're requiring, the kind of courses that they're directing school districts to implement. It's not just the school board.
Bob, you mentioned earlier some non-traditional efforts that the federal government can actually exercise in sort of instilling American virtue and providing historical and civics analysis through, for example, organizations or institutions like the Smithsonian Institution. We also have a historic anniversary, 250th anniversary of our nation's birth that we have coming up. What are some opportunities within these contexts that the federal government can actually sort of provide civics history analysis for children who are so clearly failing in being taught appropriately in those environments?
Sure. So, I always look, you know, for those of us of a certain age who are aware of the bicentennial in 1976, we'll look upon the bicentennial as a grand event in American history. It certainly made it. I was, an adolescent at the time, but it made an impression on me, and I think others of my generation who were there to witness it. It taught me it introduced me to American history in a way that nothing had before. And this was a public-private, to a great extent, federally led type of event that celebrated 200 years of American independence. And I frankly, just an aside, look forward to the 250th next year. And I don't see the same excitement. I don't see the same energy. I don't see the same attention on our semisesquicentennial that we saw for the bicentennial. And I think it will be a missed opportunity if we do not take advantage of it. So, I guess this is a call for the federal government to take a major role in the 250th planning. I know that there is a commission doing that, but frankly, I think that the feds need to step up their game on this and get focused on the momentous events that will happen next year. I actually believe that the bicentennial and the education that came through that laid the groundwork for the patriotism, the rise in patriotism that you saw in the 1980s during the Reagan years. I think it laid the sort of the cultural communitarian foundation for a feeling of goodwill about the United States. And was thus very important, I think, to this resurgence of national values and patriotic feeling. I'm not seeing that right now, and I hope we get back to it.
Roger, what are your perspectives on opportunities that the federal government might have to educate students through sort of these historic events or through some of its institutions like the Smithsonian or the National Archives?
Well, civics education is severely lacking, and it's necessary for our citizenry. They have to be properly educated in our system of government, and we do a very poor job of it. Now, the federal government has a requirement for civics education for naturalization. If you want to become an American citizen, you have to learn the basics of what it means to be an American and what it means to live in our system, our way of life. So if that were a requirement on children as well, pushed by the states themselves, right, not from the federal government, but the states were to require mandatory civics education, then that would be wonderful. Equivalent at least to what we say is necessary to be a citizen of our country. That's a missed opportunity.
Now, we know that the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, allows for the right of parents to examine curriculum and instruction. But not every parent understands sort of pedagogically where that particular curriculum and instruction is going to benefit or fail their child in sort of standards of learning and traditional opportunities to achieve with a degree that's worth the paper it's printed on. Is there a role for the federal government at all in curricular transparency above and beyond the ESSA, or rigor and approaching sort of an opportunity for examination and explanation for parents who are stakeholders in public education?
There's a role for transparency, and the federal government should collect data on a national level. Okay, that only the federal government can do that. We want to get a sense of where the country is when it comes to outcomes of, is the educational inputs leading to good jobs for these people? Are they getting into college and that sort of thing? So data gathering, sure, that's an appropriate role. Some form of transparency. I mean, look, we have the opposite where we have the federal restrictions on education information being dispersed, which is the equivalent of HIPAA for state and local governments and their schools. So it actually restricts the amount of information that could get out, generally speaking, as opposed to creating more transparency. We don't want federal mandates, though. That's the thing we want to avoid, because once they get their hands on things, the strings come with it, and that usually ends up with worse education outcomes.
Two thoughts on that. Roger's right about federal data collection and analysis. There is a role for the federal government to do so. There's something called the Institute for Education Sciences, which plays a critical role in connection with it, what people will know as the nation's report card, which is a very valuable tool for occasional assessment or students or tracking. And so there is a strong, we strongly endorse what IES does in that regard, the responsibility for it. So there's that. In terms of curriculum transparency, we strongly support a right to parent, for parents to know what is being taught in the classroom, and we strongly support a parental bill of rights in that regard. Not that bill is perfect, but it was certainly a movement in the right direction. And part of that bill was the right of parents to see the curriculum and curriculum materials that their children were being taught in public schools. Currently, there are on the books two laws: FERPA, the Family Educational Rights Responsibility Privacy Act, FERPA. And the people, the PPRA, the
Protection of People Rights Amendment.
Thank you for helping me. I always refer to them by their acronyms. But the FERPA and the PPRA provide rights for parents to obtain records and to opt out of surveys. And the rights that they provide are valuable and great. The problem is, there's really no way to enforce it. All that you are able to do to enforce it is if you can't get cooperation from your school district, is to file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education, which is understaffed and can take months, if not years, to resolve a complaint. In our view, these protections for parents need to be beefed up significantly by Congress. To the point where I would argue they should have the right to sue to enforce these statutory rights in court. But that's another conversation.
That itself would take an entire webinar, I think.
Yes. But no, this is important. Parents should sue when the rights are being violated. There's another case before the Supreme Court, Mahmoud versus Taylor, where parents had no right to opt out of curriculum that was highly sexualized content for 3 and 4 year olds that dealt with all the hot button LGBT issues and identity questions, putting this indoctrinating children into these things. And the school district said, no, you don't have a right to opt out, and you don't have a right to even be notified ahead of time of this highly sexualized content, right? And that's the thing, is the schools should be inculcating virtue, but the parents should be ultimate determiners of that. So they should have a right to opt out when it violates their parental rights. And this is framed as a religious freedom question, but it even goes deeper than that. And I hope the Supreme Court will rule in favor of the parents on this one for sure.
And I'm pleased to say that DFI filed an amicus brief in that case explaining why it does not pose an administrative burden for school systems to have this opt-out process. And we did so on behalf of about a dozen former state education agency heads and school superintendents and teachers making that argument. Very proud of it. And I agree with you, Roger. That's an important one to watch. It's Mahmoud versus Montgomery County. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we all support a parent's bill of rights, by the way.
Yeah.
Defending Education also filed an amicus brief in that case as well. And we argued that it was a fairly straightforward application of Wisconsin versus Yoder, the 1972 Supreme Court case, in which the Supreme Court determined that when there was a clash between public education and the religious rights of parents to direct their child's upbringing, it would be the parents' right to raise their child that would prevail. I do hope that they get beyond the First Amendment analysis and get us to the 14th Amendment, that tricky substantive due process analysis, which, you know, while many of us who are more textualist, originalist thinkers on these issues like to avoid generally, the fact of the matter is we have 102 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence in which the Supreme Court has said specifically it's the exclusive purview of a parent to direct their child's education and upbringing. In fact, it was even Justice Kagan during oral arguments who herself said, I think parents who are not religious would also find this material inappropriate for 5, 6, and 7-year-olds. So that will be a distinctly important case, I think, to watch. And it is the first time the Supreme Court's weighed in 25 years on the parental rights issue. So I think it will matter directly to what we're talking about today. I see that we are getting close to time, so I'll give each of you just a minute or two to offer closing remarks.
Good, Runner.
Okay. So I have several school kids, they're in private schools. I would not entrust my children's souls to the public education system. And it is sad. I have the luxury of choice. Most Americans don't. Now, many states have adopted education school choice as an option. And it really comes back to follow the money. Whoever controls the money really controls the outcome ultimately. And our system is such that it is a government monopoly dominated by teachers' unions, and the federal footprint has been in control of a greater and greater share of that money and has been trying to dictate from the top what the policies shall be. It's got to be closer to the people. If it's going to be, you know, federal dollars, then it should be block granted to the states. But greater than that, it really comes down to making sure the education monopoly is broken. There has to be options, whether it's starting with charter schools, private schools, religious schools. Give the parents the money, and then they will be the ones who control the educational outcomes and not the bureaucrats.
So I think the answer to the question, should there be a role for the federal government in a national curriculum or shape national curriculum? The answer to that is, I think the consensus on this is no, it should not. I think that the key here is, and time is going short, but I think the key here is for parents, advocate for education freedom policies in your state, fight the teacher unions, watch closely what they're doing, keep them out of their school system if they're not there, and if they are there, do whatever you can to lessen their influence, and know what your school boards are doing. And then finally, keep the federal government out of it. And support efforts by groups like DFI and Heritage to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education.
And with that, I will conclude our webinar right on the nose.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.